The Playlist with Ben and Fiona.
If you saw the hashtag release the Snyder Cut, yeah, they did.
Welcome to The Playlist, where we talk about movies and TV shows that are worth your time. I'm Fiona Williams, and I manage our online coverage of movies and TV here at SBS, and I'm joined by my co-host, SBS and SBS Viceland Channel Manager, Ben Nguyen. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Fee. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good.
That's good. I'm sure you've been, like me, binging a lot of content over the last couple of weeks.
So much stuff, yes.
So much stuff that today we decided to devote the whole episode to an extra long What Have You Been Watching as we share our reactions to the four-hour-long Zack Snyder's Justice League, the Academy Award-nominated Romanian documentary Collective, the new season of investigative documentary series Exposed, The Ghost Train Fire, and we await the launch of the brand new season of Line of Duty. And plus, we'll have a preview of a hot new SBS On Demand movie collection straight out of Hong Kong.
Like I said, so much stuff.
I know. Let's get into it.
Where do we start?
Well, Fee, I guess sort of the headline launch over the last couple of weeks has been finally all those Zack Snyder fans who have been waiting for his cut of Justice League to be released, they got their wish.
Mm-hmm. If you saw the hashtag release the Snyder Cut, yeah, they did.
and you sat down for all 4 hours, 2 minutes of it.
Yeah.
I have to admit, so I watched the original, I mean, credited to Zack Snyder, but it was, after in quite tragic circumstances, he had to leave the production. The film was finished by Joss Whedon.
He took the scissors to what had been produced.
Yeah, and it's an interesting one because, I mean, the film definitely was bad. I saw it on a plane and just thought it was going to be, you know, just a fun little couple of hours of escapism. But it didn't look good. The special effects were dodgy. There was sort of notably because Joss Whedon had brought in all the actors for reshoots in order to give it sort of a lighter, more Avenger-like tone. And Henry Cavill as Superman was still full mustachioed from his role in Mission Impossible. And they CGI'd out the moustache, and his upper lip is doing all sorts of strange things during that film. You know, I think probably in some ways that was the highlight of the film.
At least we had the lip to look at.
But Zack Snyder's come back. He's reshot some material that he originally intended. He's shot some material that was never really intended, but in order to kind of flesh out his full vision. Well, first of all, you know, where do you sit on the Zack Snyder, you know, kind of spectrum? And, you know, like I think for whatever you think of him, he certainly has a kind of strong visual aesthetic.
Yes.
That he does work through all his films, which have included things like the adaptation of Watchmen, that film set in an asylum. What's that one called with the women who have... Now I'm going to have to look it up.
Yeah, same. Maybe we'll... I don't know what you're talking about. Which? Oh, God, not that one. Oh, my God.
That one.
God, what was that called? I had an argument with my husband about it. he liked it. I did not. Sucker Punch.
Oh, yes.
Yep. That one.
So, you know, people who have seen those movies, they know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. I think I've just answered your question.
Okay, all right. So I'm going with not a huge lover of Zack Snyder's back catalogue.
I did not care for Sucker Punch. I forgot he made it. I blocked that I watched it, but then it came back like a sucker punch, let's say. Boom tish. No, look, he doesn't leave anything on the floor. I can really tap out when it just gets too much. And his Justice League, the original idea for Justice League was coming off the back of Batman versus Superman, Dawn of
Justice. Yeah.
Yep. Where we first got our glimpse of Wonder Woman, et cetera. But also that film was the whole plot hinged around they made up because their mums had the first same name. Like, I don't know.
I have to admit, you know, that plot point was was cringe-inducing. But I went into both those first two movies, Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman, with very low expectations. Mm. And you know what? I had a fine time with them. Mm-hmm. So I have some anticipation around actually seeing this Snyder Cut of Justice League, but should I put myself through it? That's my big question.
That's the thing. And, you know, popcorn movies, I saw both of those films in the cinemas and the collective groan around the mum's first name is quite a time. That's fun.
Well, not many people are called Martha, all right?
It's true. And you've got to make friends with the ones whose mums were called that.
You've got to find what you've got in common.
Exactly. It's, you know, message for our time. But absolutely you should watch it if you've got 4 hours and 2 minutes to kill. If you're on board for that, also, because of the backstory of how this film got made, I don't care for this toxic fandom where you bully people to make the movie you want them to make. It just happens to have improved Justice League in this instance, but can we not make that a habit?
You say that now, but when there's something that you really want to see happen, I'll hold you to it.
Sure. Yeah, release the big business cut, the four-hour version of that. But anyway, like you say, Zack Snyder did have to leave the film for very tragic reasons. Also, at the time, he was receiving copious studio notes. They were wanting him to lighten up the film because Batman versus Superman did end with killing off Superman, and, you know, that's a bit of a Debbie Downer. So the studio wanted a bit of chuckles in the next one that Joss Whedon tried to provide.
And I guess, you know, in that context, we've obviously got this cinematic clash between DC, owned by Warner Brothers, and Marvel, owned by Disney. And Joss Whedon, I think we've learnt a lot about the way that he operates behind the scenes, and none of it good in recent times, including on Justice League.
Yeah.
But I think he was credited with directing that first Avengers movie and making it into a hit with sort of the jokes and the one-liners and the character moments. And Marvel have talked about how they deliberately bring in directors from television because they're not looking for someone who's going to implant their entire directorial vision. They want someone who can collaborate a moment with a bunch of actors in a room, which is kind of more the mentality of television. And it's worked well for Marvel. So in some ways you can sort of see Warner Brothers' interest in trying to recreate that over at DC. And I guess lightness of touch, a lack of directorial vision, that's not what Zack Snyder does for a living.
No. No, his fingerprints very much on his films in the best and worst ways, shall we say.
Yeah, very heavy fingerprints.
Yeah, he's really put those marks in there. Indelible. And so he got his chance. The hashtag worked. And look, it's no small thing that he got to go back and make the film he wanted to make, which he had to leave in very tragic circumstances. He devotes his film to his late daughter. That is no small thing, and that is great for him. And I don't mean that in a sarcastic way. So how is the film? It is better, but it also is way, way longer. As we've mentioned, it's 4 hours, 2 minutes. It's a good 90 minutes in and they're still setting up the characters. And there is a lot of slow motion. And I did quit, like, you could lean on the fast forward for a lot of this because you could just make it real time. But one thing that was at issue in the Joss Whedon version is there's a character, Cyborg, who wasn't in any previous film but is part of the Justice League and got super short shrift in the old version of Justice League.
Yeah.
It was kind of a pointless inclusion. Didn't really know what this guy's story was. Very light touch.
Yeah.
His whole backstory gets restored in this version for the better. Like, he's a key part of the league now. And Ray Fisher has his own stories about Joss Whedon, so that may point to some of how he got cut out. So I do encourage you to go read Ray Fisher's
accounts.
Yeah. Exactly. And all of these films, especially Zack Snyder films, do have this buy into the superhero arc of parents and children and the legacy, etc., which takes on a resonance here for his reasons. But for the Cyborg storyline, that comes in as well in a really interesting and quite empathetic way. So it backfills a lot of the stories where the first film really heroed Batman and Wonder Woman. So everyone sort of gets a far more far more, with way more slow motion, fully fleshed out storylines, because it's got 4 hours to do that. And I don't mind long films. Like, I love, I'm on record with Nuri Bilge Ceylan's Turkish films that are at least 3 hours, but I don't feel it. And this is 4 hours, 2 minutes, and it feels, well, it feels every one of those minutes, maybe a few more for me. But it's a more complete story, and you do get more of a sense of where Zack Snyder was going with this, including an epilogue that he's tacked on with Joker and Batman that will go nowhere now that he's not making more films. But it's a curious little tack on at the end.
I mean, I suppose in some ways this is a very expensive curiosity and I suppose it's about the whole purpose behind this in some ways is to indulge one man and his fan base. And so, you know, I suppose in that regard, it's successful.
Absolutely. Settle in. This is what you wanted and they've given you that and then some. Yeah, look, a lot of people are very happy with it. I think, you know, it's I'm really killing it with faint praise here. Like, it's better, but it's also a bit of a slog.
And Zack Snyder's Justice League is available to watch on Binge or on Foxtel. Well, let's change pace to something quite different, the documentary Collective.
Ooh, yes. It's nominated for an Oscar 2 times over. It's a documentary, so it's in the feature documentary category, but it is also from Romania, so it is up for Best International Feature as well, which was also the case for Honeyland last year, crossed categories as well. So I love that they're doing that. I love that international films are being recognised outside of just that category.
Yeah.
Because this is extraordinary. It's called Collective, and it's from an investigative documentary maker, Alexander Nanau. And it's shocking. It's called Collective, which is one of those titles that plays on a lot of levels. But there was a club called Collective that had a fire when people were there for a gig, and shocking, horrific, so many casualties. And the number of casualties overloaded the health system. But then it continued to beyond the time it should have. So people kept dying, and not just from their injuries from this fire. And so it was weird and devastating, but it took some digging by a team of dogged journalists who work for a sports gazette to expose the shocking corruption and graft. And I can't, like, I won't even do it justice if I try and touch on what is at the root of this film. But it just keeps peeling away the layers, and it's just more and more rot in healthcare system. And it's about the pursuit of journalists to get to the bottom of this story, because it was a scandal and it toppled a health minister. And we also follow the new health minister who's installed, who is a reformer. He's got a history as a patient advocate. So he's trying to fix the system. But in digging a little deeper, he just finds more and more problems. So how can a reformer reform when he doesn't know the full extent of what the problem is? So sounds horrendously depressing, and it is, and it's very upsetting. But it's inspiring as well, because you see it's a tribute to journalists and good politicians, you know, people who are there for a purpose and try and get to the bottom of it. But there's backlash. Of course there is, because there's a lot of people with vested interests here. And also what elevates it as well is there's a story of a woman who was a victim of the fire, and she's an artist, and her story is weaved in amongst this, and she's her recovery and resilience is alluded to. We don't actually speak to her, but we see her and we see a portrait of her in this politician's office. So, like, she's kind of this beacon of hope throughout the film that, it's incredible. I watched it and my jaw dropped. It's beautiful and devastating. A lot of, you know, tears and upset. But, thoroughly encourage you to watch it. It's coming out. It's got a season in Sydney at the Dendy Newtown from the 8th of April. And it's also screening for regional New South Wales audiences, at least. Sorry for other states. I don't know where it's going. But in New South Wales, it's screening at the Screenwave International Film Festival in April, which I'm going to, which is in Coffs Harbour on the northern coast of New South Wales. So there are two places I know you can see it. And, if you see it's on near you, do see it, it's quite a revelation.
Make a beeline. That sounds fascinating and so relevant when, you know, clearly health systems around the world are under the microscope, given that we're in a global pandemic.
Yep.
And, you know, the question of corruption is ever present amid calls within Australia for a federal ICAC, amongst other stories around the world. So it sounds incredible and a good contender to take away those Oscars.
Yeah. I haven't seen all the documentary nominees yet. We have spoken about Crip Camp. That's up as well, which I loved as well. So, I don't know. They're all good. And The Mole Agent as well. I'm seeing that actually at Screenwave as well. They tend to get a lot of the good Oscar nominated docs. So that one looks great. Haven't seen it yet, but hope to speak of that. It's about an undercover spy in a nursing home in Chile. So I'll talk about that when I've seen it.
Well, it's interesting that you mention A Deadly Fire and evidence of corruption, because that actually leads me to what I've just been watching, which is just playing out now on ABC in Australia, the documentary Exposed, the Ghost Train Fires.
Four schoolmates were among the seven who perished.
They were right in front of me.
And everything you've loved is gone.
I saw the police cars and I thought, oh my God.
Everybody said it was an accident. It's taken me 40 years to finally tell my story.
I was one of the first detectives on the scene.
I've never spoken publicly.
The fire was a result of an electrical fault.
If the fuse box was the cause, how is it one of the only things still standing?
What do you think caused this fire?
Arson.
It's arson.
Arson, yeah.
The cover-up was monumental.
There is somebody that got away with murder.
It's time for the truth.
People might be familiar with the first season, which was looking into the mystery around Kelly Lane and her daughter. And that was received very well. They dug up sort of a lot of new information around that case, you know, with the help of citizen detectives or, you know, amateur sleuths or sort of however you want to label them, which is something that I am really fascinated in the way that true crime is digging into these true crime programs. But this new season looks at a deadly accident, or was it, that occurred in 1979 at Luna Park, the theme park in Sydney that's right on the foreshore of the harbour, looking over onto the Harbour Bridge and the Opera House. And that theme park itself has a fascinating history, having been transplanted from Glenelg in South Australia in the 1930s and then having a whole sort of torrid history through the war years, with a lot of servicemen using it as a place for rest and relaxation and other activities. But ultimately, that leads us to this story of sort of a number of survivors of this fire, this horrible fire that took place on the Ghost Train ride. And we hear from one man who, at the time, he was a child, a teenager, traveling with his friends for the first time. They were traveling from the eastern suburbs of Sydney on their own without their parents, sort of to go hang out at this park. We also hear the story of a woman who, she lost her husband and her two young sons in the fire. So there were seven deaths altogether. It always was described as being an accident caused by an electrical fault. And certainly, you know, it wasn't helped by the fact that there wasn't the kind of safety steps in place that we would expect now, even just things like emergency exits, for example. So it literally became a death trap for the people who were on the ride at the time. But it sort of has had ongoing unanswered questions. And the artist Martin Sharp, who had become quite involved in the 70s with Luna Park, with kind of giving a sort of a pop art new look to the park, this event became his obsession. And he has been, you know, sort of, he's now passed away, but until his death he was collecting newspaper clippings and recordings that he made with people who had been witnesses to the event. And in the first episode we go into his home, and it's, you know, literally one of those almost conspiracy theory rooms that is just filled to the brims with all this paraphernalia to do with Luna Park and that specific event. The only thing it's missing is the red string to connect the dots. But, you know, through that it allows the filmmaker and the lead reporter, Caro Meldrum-Hanna, to begin to piece bits of the puzzle together, things that were overlooked at the time and allegedly covered up. And we start to get a picture of what could have been a deliberately lit fire with its own nefarious purposes.
Mm.
And I think sort of the thing that I really wanted to say about this program is just how beautifully made it is. I think that in some ways, you know, we have to give credit to the Netflixes of the world that have elevated true crime and given this genre big budgets, because the way that the archive not only is treated, not only the specific news footage from the fire itself, but just so many little period glimpses that of, you know, sort of kids' birthday parties or someone sort of mowing a lawn in the late 1970s, and it's just a window into that era, and that's so beautifully done, and the way that the still photos are kind of recreated as part of people's photo albums is so beautifully done. There's little techniques used, like going from an image, an archive image, into the building today to kind of connect the dots between the past and the present. And then the other thing that makes this so extraordinary is from everyone from the ticket collector through to people who were on the ride just before the accident occurred and family members of those who perished, they're all interviewed, they all tell their stories, and they all have such vivid memories of that period of their lives that has stuck with them because of the trauma that they experienced. Mm. And so it's a difficult watch.
Yeah.
Because it's quite difficult for them to recount that story, but it is a very, very vivid experience reliving those moments, those fateful moments with all of those survivors and the loved ones of those who passed away. So, yeah, I would strongly recommend this. I thought it was fantastic. So the first two episodes of Exposed are out now on ABC iView, and the third episode will be released this week.
Okay, I will have to see that. So what else have you been watching?
Well, the show that I'm highly anticipating, it launches in Australia on the 1st of April, but it's the first episode's already gone out in the UK to record numbers, over 9 million viewers, is Line of Duty, the police drama. And so this, I've been catching up with the past seasons just in readiness of the new season launching. This is written by Jed Mercurio, who had a big hit recently with Bodyguard, the British drama, which went out on Netflix internationally and the BBC in the UK. But he has a background. He worked as a doctor, and the first drama that he ever wrote was a series set in a hospital called Bodies, a very dark look at the hospital system in the UK. I feel like often the darkness in an American story comes through a particular individual, and it's sort of the anti-hero. Or we sort of see, if the system's the problem, we see a story of someone who's railing against the system and trying to change it. Sometimes I think the Brits just really enjoy just sitting in how dysfunctional and with no light at the end of the tunnel. And that was certainly true of Bodies, which was an exploration of just all the problems within the health system. So echoes of...
Oh, geez, it's a real theme.
...of collective, as we were talking about before. But Line of Duty is about the police. It is about police corruption. So at the centre of Line of Duty is one unit, AC-12, an anti-corruption unit, and the investigations that they carry out in order to bag bent coppers. And, you know, I think sort of what rapidly becomes a big pleasure of the series is the lead characters involved who recur season after season, and you do really get to love and adore them. But the other big pleasure of the show is that we usually get one new character actor per season, and there's been people like Tandy Newton before and Keely Hawes. And in the most recent season, Stephen Graham, really terrific British character actors who, you know, often have, you know, some unselfish motives or they're being blackmailed for various reasons. But you know, it's the cat and mouse exercise that's really enjoyable. And one thing that I really love about this show is the interview scenes themselves, interrogation scenes. And I think there's not an interrogation scene that goes by in this series where there isn't some sort of turning of the tables of the power in the room. So you sort of, whether it's that the suspect is aloof and has a complete disregard for what the detectives have on him or her, and you know, that power flips, or the detectives feel as though they've nailed this person, and then sort of slowly their case begins to unravel before their eyes. I think that writing is really incredible. I think the series has gotten a little bogged down over time with all the recurring storylines, which sort of have meant that it becomes less about the singular case that they're going after and more about sort of the backstory and the kind of who is a suspect within the force itself and how far up does this chain go. But all that said, I think that there'll be lots of twists and turns and reveals in this new season. So that's one that I'm eagerly awaiting, which is going to launch here on BritBox, but you can find the previous seasons all over the place on ABC and Netflix and other services as well.
Yeah, great. Sounds good. There is a bit of a theme in this episode that we did not anticipate.
We did not. But it does bring us to our final item, which, you know, we always do like talking up some of the treasures that are available free on SBS On Demand.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that we might even get a little hint of police corruption itself in some of these titles. Fee, there is a collection focusing on the cinema of Hong Kong. And what's getting you excited there? What have you got to recommend?
Yeah, well, actually, to continue this episode's unintended theme, Infernal Affairs, that incredible trilogy of films about corruption, the you know, a little hunter has become the hunted situation going on, but also about identity, you know, undercover moles in both the police and in mafia. It, you know, they're two moles on either side, rising through the ranks across years. There's prequel, sequel.
Yeah.
You know, it's the definitive trilogy remade for Oscar winner, dare I say, The Departed.
Yeah.
So if you're familiar with that, go back and watch Infernal Affairs. Please go rewatch them if you've seen them.
Yeah. I would be shocked if Infernal Affairs is not actually a big influence on Line of Duty as well. So I think that there's many links there.
Yeah, I think much copied in many ways, no doubt, yeah. And with fantastic performances by Tony Leung and Andy Lau as both moles planted in the police and the mafia and struggling with, like, they're living a lie, reporting back to their higher-ups, but, you know, it's just fascinating, the machinations that work in these. So we've got all three at SBS On Demand. You can dive right into. Yeah, it goes well beyond kind of good versus evil, which side are you on kind of thing. It really gets into questions about identity, and I love them.
Yeah, it's great stuff. And the Wong Kar-wai films, there's two there.
There is two, and before anyone asks, no, we don't have In the Mood for Love. Because that was my first question as well. Oh, we have In the Mood for Love. Yeah. No, but don't at me. but you can see these are his first films. We've got As Tears Go By and Days of Being Wild, and which were before In the Mood for Love. But you can see the style start to emerge. This beautiful, his definitive style, the language, living in the mood of a scene. It's not so much what's said, it's what's not said, just the stylistic flourishes that are such a part of his filmmaking that I love. And just on In the Mood for Love, It's one of my all-time favourites, why I keep bringing it up. But I did have the chance to watch that about a month ago when Sydney Film Festival had their summer season. Yeah, just keeps getting better every time I watch it. But I shouldn't talk it up because we don't have it on that collection. But
we love all cinema and television, no matter where you find it.
It's
but,
true.
But Wong Kar-wai is a director that if he was, for whatever reason, removed from production and wasn't able to put his definitive stamp, I would be campaigning to release his cut.
Yes, good point. Yeah, give me 4 hours if I'm going to put up. But yeah, that whole, the mood and the sensuality that and sadness that's in all of his films, they're fantastic. And in these two, they're his, you know, first features, and Maggie Cheung has been there the whole way through. Like she's in these, and she's of course in The Mood for Love. But then to finish off the Hong Kong cinema collection, this featured collection anyway, there are other films you can watch, but there's a Bruce Lee collection with some of his biggies. You know, in the early 70s where he returned to Hong Kong after a decade in the US, and this is where the legend was born.
Totally.
You know, we've got The Big Boss, which, you know, he promises his mum he won't he won't use those fists of fury, but quite spectacularly breaks his pledge to his mama. So we've got The Big Boss, we've got Fist of Fury, The Way of the Dragon, which the one with Chuck Norris in the Coliseum, the definitive showdown.
Yeah, these are so iconic and sort of for a while were hard to find.
Yes.
So it's good to be able to make them available to people. And we did recently have a documentary about Bruce Lee on SBS called Be Water, which told his story very interestingly through his experience of racism in the US. But, you know, it was just another reminder to go out and see the films that have obviously been so influential.
Absolutely. Then speaking to his legacy, the one made posthumously and cobbled together through shot footage and archive and stunt doubles, Game of Death, we've got that too. And that's, of course, the jumpsuit. It's iconic.
The Kill Bill jumpsuit.
The Kill Bill. The Taskmaster jumpsuit, if you've seen the Phil Wang series coming up on SBS Viceland, I believe, soon.
Yes. Well, listeners won't know, but I'm actually wearing that jumpsuit right now.
It's why I brought it up, frankly. But I'm glad you're sitting down. It.
Well, that's so much to watch.
There is a lot, and it goes more than 4 hours, and it's worth every minute.
Yeah, yeah, and all available right now on SBS On Demand. And I think that brings us to the end of our show. So make sure you subscribe to SBS The Playlist wherever you get your podcasts and give us a lot of stars. Leave a nice review because it helps people to find the show. And you can let us know what you thought of the movies and TV shows we discussed on Facebook or Twitter at SBS Movies. And I'm on Twitter at Ben Nguyen TV.
And I'm on Twitter at Anything But Fifi.
And The Playlist is produced by Jeremy Wilmot, appearing today on a tiny little phone screen. Hey, Jez.
Hello.
Until next time.
Thanks for listening.